Hello and welcome to What a Scream, the horror movie podcast where I, your host, Egrain, chats with a special guest every week about horror films. And in particular, we talk about a certain subject that I've previously randomly chosen. So the two films that we are going to be talking about, me and my special guest, who is Devon Taylor this week, we are going to be talking about twist endings in horror. And the two films are Perfect Blue from 1997, directed by Satoshi Kon, and The Sixth Sense from 1999, directed by M. Night Shyamalan. So enjoy this chat about twist endings in horror.
So I would like to welcome to What a Scream for the very first time. I have Devon Taylor with me. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm very excited to get into some twisty-turny movies today.
I know, it's going to be a roller coaster of shock and, well, for at least one of the films. I think the other film, no one's shocked anymore about this ending, but sure, look, we'll get into it. So first off, would you like to introduce yourself and let listeners know who you are and what you do?
Yeah, so my name is Devon Taylor, and I host a horror movie podcast, The Spectre Cinema Club, with my buddy Garrett McDowell, and every month we pick a different theme, and we go into the subgenres within horror is kind of what we based our conversations around. And I also written for previous outlets and things like that, and an aspiring filmmaker myself. So, kind of getting into the topic for today, we'll kind of get into a little bit more of that. But yeah, so that's basically what I do. And, I just sit around, I get stoned, and I tweet about horror movies. It's my jams.
Yeah. Living the dream. isn't that what truly, we all aspire truly, to do?
Truly.
So how did you get into horror? And do you remember what the first horror film was you ever saw?
So I was actually talking to my mom about this today because we're recording on Mother's Day, and she was the one that introduced me to horror films. She loves them. My dad absolutely hates them. So like that was like kind of a bonding thing for us. And it was a Nightmare on Elm Street. And she didn't remember that was the first one that she showed me. And she goes, oh, damn. She goes, I really threw you in, huh? And I go, yeah. I go, pretty much. I was like, we went straight into the serious stuff. But and that was like when I was like seven. So that was like one of my very first ones. Cube was another like early one from my childhood that like kind of piqued my interest into the genre. Now, I've been into it ever since. And I used to... as a kid, I used to write these short stories, and I would like read them to like the class, and they were very like Goosebumps-esque, like very formulaic. And so talking about twists today is very funny because I remember the like calling card for these things was like, I had a formula, and I was able to like crank these bad boys out and everything. But one of the big things was, oh, there's gonna be a twist at the end, like the big, it made me feel like I was like, oh yeah, I'm gonna really get them, and like it ended up being like a fun thing that whenever I would tell people like the story I'm working on, like, ooh, I wonder what the twist is gonna be, and like I was like, oh shit, now I gotta be the twist guy. So so I had that kind of influence whenever I was younger. I dropped out of college and I had a lot of time on my hands. So I was just watching so many movies. And then that's kind of what like got me into start writing about them. And then being like, I think I could make a movie one day. And so that's what I'm out here in sunny LA working towards.
That's great. Do you think, so there's always like two types of horror fans. There's the ones whose parents got them into like way too young, like you said, 7 years old watching Nightmare on Elm Street, and then there's the ones that kind of got into it themselves. Do you think that kind of shapes who you are as an adult and what you kind of become, like you kind of get into as an adult if you are shown these things at quite a young age?
I think so. I mean, I think, everybody kind of has a different journey with horror films, and I think starting out with them like so young kind of like made it more of an evolution of, you know, kind of going from, I kind of got over the shock and awe of it pretty early. So then I was able to then like start being able to like watch them for like, you know, be like, ooh, like for this like interesting imagery or, you know, or these, you know, interesting stories that you can kind of tell without any limits, you know? So So I think getting past that like allowed me to kind of open my brain to more horror movies at the time, because I also like, you know, everybody has that uncle that has a movie collection and half of them nobody's ever even heard of. So it was like, I was really able to kind of take it all in rather than just like kind of looking for only like just like the scary stuff. And I think that does translate maybe a little too well for me as an adult. Like I won't say that I'm like not scared of things, but like I think I'm a little too comfortable, you know, just like being out late at night. Maybe it's the bartender in me as well. Like I'm, you know, I feel myself a little too at ease, you know, walking down the street at 3 a.m. and being like, oh yeah, all is okay. Oh yeah, I could totally cut through this alley and it's gonna be okay. Like, you know, I think I might be a little too comfortable from being immersed early. I don't know.
Yeah, I find it really interesting because like I didn't get into horror films since I was a teenager, and that was just through my own doing. But now I have a child and he's 5. So he's at the age that a lot of my guests have been like, oh, I accidentally saw The Exorcist at age 5. So he's at that age now, and like he has always been exposed to horror elements. So like I've got loads of horror toys. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, he's watched stuff like the 1930s Dracula and Frankenstein. Like he's seen all of these. He's not bothered by them. Like he's not into them, but he's not bothered by them. Type of things he is scared of is like dogs in cartoons. Like if he sees a big scary dog in a cartoon, he's like, no way, absolutely not. But I just wonder that perhaps because he's not scared by this, you know, he's like, that's a vampire, that's a zombie, and he's not scared by them. And I just wonder, like, is he already desensitized to monsters like at 5 years old?
Yeah, and like it kind of has him just like already being on the lookout for like, you know what, like, you know, it's really scary, the real world, you know. Yeah. The things that are out there, it's like, dang kid, like, yeah, these kids, they learn quick.
They sure do. So yes, let's move on to our topic then. It is twist endings, which is a formula that is used quite a bit in horror, I guess. What do you think about its usage? Do you think that it is effective, or do you think sometimes it's very overused in the genre?
Yeah, I was trying to think of like what genre kind of uses the twist endings the most. And yeah, it does definitely tend to be in the genre realms, whether it be in mysteries or thrillers, or especially used in horror. And yeah, I think it's a touchy subject that I feel like, you know, a lot of people can be down on twist endings when it's the only thing to the movie. You know, I think some people kind of think of it as like sometimes it can be a cop out or a cheap way out, you know, something like that. And it can be, and like, and but that's when it's like not, when effort's not put into it. And, you know, for pulling off a twist ending, it's actually not easy. It's not as simple as just being like, oh, I'm going to just change my mind of what I was doing and pivot the story this way. It's like, no, like if you want to actually pull off a twist ending, you got to actually like put a lot of effort into it to, you know, very much set it up so that way it has the proper payoff. So yeah, I see the way that people can say that like it is overdone, especially like, yeah, maybe if you're you know, making a movie and, you know, the story is maybe not the highlight, but you still got to do something to it, so maybe people throw it in like that. So it's tough in that angle, but for me as a writer and like aspiring filmmaker, I don't think that I'm smarter than films or anything, but I'm pretty good at predicting things just based off of tropes and formulas and stuff. So I really do enjoy the experience of like, you know, watching something that keeps me guessing. I think like twist endings are a big hallmark for erotic thrillers. Like that's like kind of One of my criteria that I base an erotic thriller off of is is it campy? Is it sexy? And how are the twists? You know, because you kind of want to go on that ride. You know, not only just twist endings, I like movies that will put in multiple and really kind of keep you going, which, you know, is reflected in the movie that I chose for today, because it's not just twist ending. It's presented, bunched up, you know, throughout the film. There's many different avenues that you can go with it, but a good one, you know, with proper thought and effort behind it can be extremely, you know, effective and fun.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I'm one of these annoying people that you watch a movie with and I'll be like, oh, I bet it's this, and it turns out and everyone's like, oh, stay great, shut up. But it's because I've just watched so many films like that, that, like you said, you just look at the tropes and you're like, that's what it's going to be. I love films that you just have no clue it's coming. Like one of the films that really sticks out in my mind, which I talked about previously, is Seven. And that twist where you're like, holy shit, it just goes so balls to the wall wild that you're like, I did not see that coming. But then I think about films like, I think it's, is it called Boogeyman? And it's got Robert De Niro and Dakota Fanning in it. And it turns out that he is the boogeyman. He's like a child psychologist and he's trying to help his daughter or something. And it turns out he is the boogeyman. Sorry for spoiling it now for you.
No, it's okay. Well, it's okay.
But it's also not a good movie. So.
Oh. Well, I was going to say, it's good in that angle, but, also, with twist ending movies, it's, a good twist ending, too, should be able to be supported, even if you do know it. I've had experiences where I go in knowing the twist, but, you know, the fun of it is still watching how it unfolds, you know, because I'm a big rewatcher as well.
Yeah.
So movies that have twists in them are tough in that angle, because if I want to be able to rewatch it, the movie has to be able to still stand without the twist, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's something that Seven does really well, that you can rewatch it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like with one of the films we're talking about, another thing with twist endings is obviously we do spoilers on this podcast and everyone knows that coming into this podcast, but when, especially with a film like Sixth Sense, which we're going to talk about, everyone, like we were saying before we came on, that it was one of our first time watches this year, but I can guarantee you already knew the twist because everyone talks about it all the time. And it was really weird that it got spoiled so easily even before the advent of social media. And now that's made even worse by social media, is that so many times a film will come out with a twist ending and someone will spoil it on Twitter. And it's like,
we had the benefit before of you had to, you know, just have the misfortune of having that shitty friend that wanted to spoil a movie for it and just shouts it out to you. But now you just might be scrolling the day of release and people are already talking about stuff. It's like, oh, chill. Can we not?
Yeah. Yeah. For the love of God, can you not? So let's start then. Let's kick off with your choice of film. Would you like to introduce it and give a brief synopsis, please?
Yes, so I want to talk about Perfect Blue, directed by Satoshi Kon.
Mima was a pop star.
This is Mima's last performance with Cham.
Who desired to become an actress.
I really hope that I can entertain you just the same as an actress.
But sometimes, aspirations can be deadly.
I'm always watching Mima's room!
In the world of make-believe.
This is when Mima proves herself.
The price of fame.
Don't worry, Mima, it'll be all right.
May not be worth the cost of identity.
Where did this come from? How do they know so much?
Innocence is lost. Dreams become nightmares. And privacy no longer exists. Where everything you do can be seen by everyone. And those you trust are really those you should fear. Your life no longer belongs to you.
And it is based off of a novel, but it follows Mima, a pop idol, trying to enter her acting era, which has a lot of people trying to tell Mima who she should be and who she is. So between the acting industry exploiting her and a crazed stalker killing those around her, Mima's mind slowly unravels as she begins to question who she is and what is real.
So last year was my first watch of this, and like I'd never really got into anime or manga, so this was like a completely new experience for me, because I have this terrible thing where I'm like, oh, animation can't be scary, and then I watched this and I was like, oh, I'm scared. I'm so scared. I take it you're a big fan of Perfect Blue.
Yes. Well, I mean, this was also very new for me. I only watched it like maybe a few months ago once it got added to Shudder. It was a movie I'd kind of heard a lot about. I am big into anime, but oddly enough, I don't watch a lot of horror anime. I'm more in the, you know, action fantasy realms for that kind of stuff. But I had heard kind of so much about it. And about it being, you know, very, very, you know, violent and gory and graphic and all these things. And it's like, yeah, it's an animated movie, but it's super, super crazy. And so, I mean, it does have a lot of like graphic kind of violence and things like that in it. But I was not expecting just this psychological horror and drama of it all and this mystery behind it. Of literally watching this and just like I could not guess like kind of where it was going to go, and you know, it really pulled it over on me. Like it got to the end, I was like so gobsmacked. I was like, oh my god, how did I not see that coming? And like it really got you. And the reason it works so well in this film is because with the animation really makes it easy to kind of blend these different realities that Mima's experiencing. And also with this kind of meta story within a story, because she's an aspiring actress and she's taking a small role in this TV drama. And so the movie kind of will switch back and forth between like, oh, are you watching the movie, like the movie that you're watching? Mm-hmm. Or is it, oh, no, it's her filming a scene for the show that she's in the movie you're watching. So it's like all these kind of layers. Kind of disorient you to where it's kind of easy for, again, like the twist ending of this isn't like a huge twist or anything, but that's what makes it work, because it's so believable and was, you know, set up and it all makes sense. It's not like the movie tried to fool you. I mean, it was, but it didn't like, you know, like cheat, you know, like it put in all the work and put in all the details to make it happen. So I think this being in the anime medium helps it so much. It was originally, when the rights were acquired, it was going to be a live action thing. And then it ended up not going that route. And then they went to animation. I think that was the best decision for this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. So it starts off, it opens on a J-pop group named Cham. And Mima is the third member and she decides to leave. And like you said, she wants to go down the path of acting. And we are introduced very early on, like at that gig, we are introduced to her stalker, who's Mr. Mean Mania?
Is that Mania, yeah.
Mania, yeah. And there's like this amazing scene in that where he's like volunteering at the gig and he sees her on stage and he puts his hand out. And it looks like she's dancing in his hand, which is obviously the setup, like, okay, he's going to have her in the palm of his hands and he's going to do things that are going to, you know, manipulate her and kind of interfere with her life. And I really love that scene. And so people around her start dying, and it turns out that he has this idea of her from her pop idol days. And it's like, I mean, it's exactly what we see online as well as with celebrities, that people make these avatars of themselves where they're not actually who they are, but they want to project a certain way into the world, but that's not who they are in real life, and people have these ideas about them that are just not real. So I really liked that portrayal of like reality versus what people put out into the world of themselves.
Yeah, the movie is a lot about perception and, you know, the perception that you want to portray to people, like it's about, you know, Mima questioning her identity, that she's like, no, like she, this is her voluntarily. Like she doesn't want to be in, like, she's like, yeah, I love music and I love being a singer, but that's not what I want to do. I want to do more than that. I want to act. And it's her, you know, wanting to assert that versus you have the fandom of trying to be like, no, you're a pop idol. Like, and that's what you are to us. And that's what you're amazing at. And we love you for it. So that's what you need to be. And it's kind of crazy, you know, watching this movie in today's context, because there's the horror in this of like, the online Mima's room, where, you know, people talk about Mima and like, you see that people know every detail of her life. And she's like, you know, horrified by this, because she's like, how would anybody know this? The only way people know this is if, like, you know, I'm being stalked and like it's somebody super close to me, versus that today people are almost desensitized to it, because it's kind of easy to know like everybody's like personal stuff now, because it's all out there. Like, you know, you can like go to somebody's Instagram and know it's in a weird, creepy way. Like you can go to somebody's Instagram story and be like, oh, I know what they're doing. I know exactly where they are. And like, it's just like, because it's all out there. So it's like weird that's played, you know, for such a horrifying thing for Mima in this versus today. It's like, wouldn't be that way. And so it's kind of crazy.
Yeah, I like, that's one thing I like about this film as well, is that it was released in 1998 and like social media wasn't a thing back then. And now it's almost more scarier and more poignant because of, you know, these micro celebrities, and everyone has a following nowadays, whether it's like 50 people or a couple of million, like everyone has a following on social media, if you have a social media. And it's just the fact that it's more relatable nowadays. Back then you could have watched it and been like, oh, I understand celebrities are stalked. You know, I was reading about like there was a Bjork stalker that was really scary as well and wanted to kill her because she wasn't his perfect idea. And like back then you would have been like, okay, celebrities. But now everyone has the potential to have a stalker, like in that kind of online way. And yeah, it's just the fact that this film is even more scarier now than it was back then.
Yeah, and it's interesting that it still kind of plays on this, you know, again, like the version of the idol that they worship, that they like, you know, like again, like I watch people online, like the way that people tweet about Taylor Swift. I swear, I love Taylor Swift, but the Swifties are a cult of some sort, because they sit there and argue over which version of Taylor they think is best. They're like, oh no, this era of Taylor was when she was at her best. No, this era was. And it's like, you're talking about the same person. You do realize that, right? So it's like the way that people kind of latch onto that. So again, like where we kind of see this person being like, no, you are, if you're not going to be a pop idol, then I'm going to be the pop idol of you.
Yeah.
You're the imposter. And I'm just going to take that, because they're like, you know, they're claiming her identity as their own. Yeah. And then that's such a horrific thing to kind of feel like you don't have control over that. And and Mima kind of has that throughout, where she's, you know, like, okay, like I'm an actor and I'm only getting these bit roles, but like, okay, no, I want to do more. So she, you know, agrees to, you know, do these, you know, more exploitative scenes and photo shoots because she thinks that's what she needs to do, you know, to kind of fit the mold that they're looking for as, you know, what people would think of as a successful actress in that in that business.
Yeah. And then because of like people's outside perceptions of who they think she is, she starts to lose grip on reality. And like, she starts to question who she is and like, you know, am I the one doing these killings? Like what's going on? You know, she starts seeing like a ghost of her past self as a girl band member. And like, she starts suffering from like a psychosis. And it's so interesting to see how the perception of others and how others view us influences how we view ourselves and how we can lose sense of who we are as a person because of other people. And I think that's a really interesting exploration.
Yeah, she loses herself in a way that like that she's trying to find herself. And then she's again like, yeah, seeing, so it helps add into the whole twist of the situation, because it's so multi-layered that, like, yes, there is someone stalking her, but then there also is someone else that is, you know, portraying her. But so she thinks she's seeing a version of herself, but you know, that's what she sees visually. And it kind of helps put a veil over the mystery part for that, for the movie, for us. So that way, you know, so again, it's not cheating. It's just like, no, that's what Mima is seeing and what we're being presented with. Or it's also like the mystery of like, is any of this happening, or is it just the scenes that we're seeing filmed for the show? Or the one that got me the whole time was like, I thought it was, I got it. It's going to be Mima. She's going to be the one killing people herself. I was like, got it. And then it was like, oh, nope, it's not that route either. So it's like, there's so many layers on this one that, you know, makes it so complex versus just kind of a last minute, like, okay, here, we're going to reveal this.
So let's talk about the big twist then. Obviously, spoiler alert. It turns out to be Rumi, who is her, she's a publicist, is she?
And it makes through, and the way that, again, that the movie is portraying Rumi anytime that we see her is, you know, the way that Mima sees her, and Mima has always seen Rumi as like the one that's always in her corner, you know, like she's the one, in any other movie you'd be watching this and you're going, okay, yeah, at least she has Rumi. At least she has somebody looking out for her best interests and that actually cares for her.
Yeah.
And then, so whenever it's revealed that's her, when it's revealed that's her, it makes sense too, because it's like, who else would know all these details of where she is, you know, what, like her daily routines, all these things. Nobody else could have known that information except for her. So it's like, it makes sense that, you know, she's technically not getting stalked. So it's like all the reveals of it work. And then you also see that Rumi is, she's been basically having Mamania do the killings. For her, but she's the one that set up the room. So she's really been the one like psychologically tormenting Mima this entire time and kind of taking advantage of the state that she knows Mima's in. She knows, you know, how much stress she's under and this like kind of mental breaking that she's having, and she's using that to her advantage. Throughout the movie, and you see like Mima seeing like reflections or like, you know, visions and stuff, part of that are visions, but then part of that is Rumi, and that's like kind of so wild to think about. And leads to such a fun chase scene with you know, Rumi is kind of switching back and forth between you know, Mima in her classic Cham outfit versus seeing Rumi in that outfit, and like that she turned her apartment into the same thing as Mima's, and it works so good.
Yeah, and it's such an interesting, like, Rumi, it's not like she's just doing it out of badness or, you know, being an evil character. She's developed a second personality where she believes she is the real Mima, and she feels like this imposter who is, you know, Mima, she thinks is an imposter, and she is destroying her reputation, destroying her image. So now there's almost this folie à deux with Mimania and Rumi, where they both believe that Mima is an imposter and they've got to kill her to protect her image. So it's this really interesting portrayal as well of mania and of psychosis and these kind of phenomenons that happen. I mean, I guess the whole thing is just about, like you said, perception and people's perception and how mental illnesses can affect that. And I just think it's an absolutely fascinating film, and like, it's definitely one that you can rewatch even when you know the twist ending. So, you know, in that vein, it's a bit like Seven, where you can rewatch it and still enjoy it for what it is.
Yeah. And it's just so impressive too, because like, this really shows like kind of the, you know, the, what's capable of animated films again, because I feel like so much of this isn't possible if this was live action. And I've never, you know, this was like one of the first times, like besides like maybe like stop motion films, where I'm watching an anime film, like, wow, that was a brilliantly directed sequence. Like, this is a very well put together, and like, it's directed and put together as if it's live action. It's treated as such. So this is like such a great example of like showing like, you know, that like animation is, you know, no lesser, you know, medium in filmmaking, when it can, you know, push the the capabilities of the genre that you're working in. So like again, like the way that everything is set up so intentionally and everything pays off and mm-hmm. all the effort is kind of put into it just makes the twist and work so well, and the watchability to it is endless.
Yeah. One thing I do want to say is, so Mania, he is kind of presented as like disfigured, and there is a lot of tropes with, you know, bad people have physical disfigurements, and this kind of trope. What did you think about that? Do you think it's something that hasn't really aged well with this film?
I mean, I couldn't, by the way he was animated, I couldn't tell that it was like disfigured. I don't know. I thought they were just like kind of maybe going for like, he's just a really not good looking dude. Like, I don't know. I guess I never kind of thought of it in that way, but, yeah. But now that you kind of point out, it's like between that, you know, he's portrayed villainous that way. And then, you know, Rumi being portrayed villainous in a way that like, when they kind of show that visual change of it being Rumi in Mima's costume, and you mm-hmm. see the costume is like tightens on her and stuff. So like also to again be like, okay, yeah, this person that doesn't fit the image also would be considered a villain. So the fact that it's the two of them and kind of have that shared aspect to it isn't the best for sure, but I also didn't feel like it was exploitative in a way that like that his disfigurement was like a reason for any of this. You know, it's not like they like gave him some backstory that like his disfigurement happened at a Mima concert because something blah 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 happened. Like they didn't like go into any of that, so it didn't feel exploitative in that way, at least.
So would you recommend Perfect Blue to horror fans?
Oh, 100%. Like this is it's a very tight mystery thriller. It's very creepy, but it's like very like psychologically emotional as well. Kind of watch this again. Like I went into it kind of expecting like something like, I don't know, just something like super crazy, hardcore or something. And I mean, it does have some uncomfortable things in it for sure. That are definitely horrific, but really it's just like kind of the mental stress of this is really palpable and very compelling. And as we kind of pointed out, like as so many themes that are like still relevant, if not more relevant today. So definitely recommend Perfect Blue.
Yeah, I would. I think as an example of how you can do horror films using animation, I think it's a really good example of that. And like you said, psychologically, I think it's really, really good. It, you know, does the twist ending really, really well, to the point where it's not obvious from the get-go. And even if you do get it, like even if you do guess the ending, it's still a really enjoyable journey. Well, enjoyable, but yeah, an enjoyable journey to get there. So yeah, I definitely would recommend it. So let's move on then to the next film, which was my choice. And I just want to say I chose this because I think it's the most one of the most famous films and one of the most famous twist endings in a film, and kind of cemented the director as a, you know, the twist ending guy. You know, you were saying about yourself being with your stories and people were like, what's the twist ending? I feel that you can't go to a film of this guy's without being like, what's the twist ending going to be? So I chose 1999's The Sixth Sense.
You know the accident up there?
Yeah.
Someone got hurt.
They did?
A lady. She broke her neck.
Oh my God, but you can see her?
Yes.
Where is she?
Standing next to my window.
Baby, why are you shaking? Cole, what's wrong?
Did you ever talk to your mom about how things are?
I don't tell her things.
Why not?
Because she doesn't look at me like everybody else, and I don't want her to. I don't want her to know.
Know what?
I see dead people walking around like regular people.
I don't see anything. Are you sure they're there?
written and directed by M. Night Shyamalan. Shyamalan? That's how you pronounce it, isn't it?
M. Night Shyamalan.
Shyamalan. Okay, thank you. And it has pretty much a really big all-star cast. It has Bruce Willis, who is a child psychologist, who is trying to help out a young boy, Cole, played by Haley Joel Osment, and his mother is played by Toni Collette. And Cole, it turns out, he can see dead people and ghosts, and obviously it's a really disturbing thing for him, and Bruce Willis is trying to help him through that. So what do you think of The Sixth Sense?
Yeah, so this was a movie that, because, you know, the twist is so iconic and everything, and so many of the scenes and the imagery, it was like kind of one of those ones that I thought that I had seen, but I guess I hadn't until like earlier this year whenever I covered it on my podcast. And we did a whole M. Night Shyamalan month. And it was interesting to kind of go back through. I watched like pretty much most of his filmography. Mm-hmm. And we kind of had a campaign throughout the month that M. Night's not the twist guy. like he is, you know, it's a gift and a curse for him that, you know, it definitely put him on the map, and he definitely reshaped the way that we think about twist endings. But like, for me, at least, whenever I go through his filmography, I'd say maybe three of the movies have actual twists. I think other ones have, like, you know, these like kind of interesting details and, like, you know, kind of some reveals. But I think, you know, only a few of them have like true twist endings that kind of recontextualize what you just saw a little bit more. And so that's kind of where I'm like a twist purist in a way. So like, so M. Night has this reputation that, like, I feel like it helps him in one way, that people, you know, that do love that kind of stuff and like attribute that to him. Like, yeah, we love that. But then there's a lot of people, like you said, they go in to a film if it's expecting a twist. Yeah. And then when there's not, or there's you know, they get an answer that they don't like, then they're like, oh, see, he did another bogus twist. And it's like, no, yeah. So it's like, it's put these interesting expectations on his career. But being able, this was, again, like one of those movies that, watching it for the first time, knowing the twist at the end, it still works. Like, everything, the way that the film is crafted is so damn good. Mm-hmm. Like, this, it's between this and Signs for what I think is his best film. Mm-hmm. But just you know, the writing and the visual motifs that he uses to put in the clues for this twist, for it to, again, not feel like a cheap ending. It's like, no, he put in the details, he put in the work to set this entire thing up, and he reveals it in multiple stages, you know. Like, first it's halfway, we get the reveal that, like, he can see the ghost, and then we kind of get the reveal towards the end. And the thing with the twist of this movie is, it's like, yeah, it's fantastic, but like, it's not even like in the top five, like, best things going on in this movie. Like, you know, the you know, very humanistic story being told through these performances and characters is just like so compelling. And like, the twist is like a nice, like, you know, like, cherry on top at the end. But like, and it's kind of like an epilogue, really, because really we've already had, you know, the climax for Haley Joel Osment's character earlier. So it's like, we've kind of already hit that climax, and then he hits you with the Bruce Willis twist, like, just kind of on the way out, being like, oh yeah, also this. And it kind of adds that extra layer to the emotional journey that we just went on.
Yeah. So my first watch of it was literally for this podcast, and I hadn't watched I hadn't watched it previously, because I've seen every clip under the moon that, like, all shows show, you know, if you're watching like 100 scariest films ever, like, I've seen all those clips. So I felt like I'd seen it, and obviously, like, I knew the twist ending, because when this came out, everyone talked about the twist ending, and this was before social media. And so I knew what the ending was. I was like, well, there's no point me watching it. So then watching it for this, I was kind of bummed that I was like, I hate the way I've waited this long to watch it. And I also wish I could have watched it without knowing the ending, because it is such a good build up. And then obviously we get a bit of a recap at the end where he's twists, you know, spoiler alert, in case you lived under a rock and didn't know this ending, it turns out Bruce Willis is dead. And but there's loads of signs, like you said. You know, Cole at one point is like, I see dead people and sometimes they don't know they're dead. And you know, he's like staring at him, and there's just, I just love the fact that, like, you could go back, you know, there's a scene where he goes to a restaurant with his wife and it seems as though he's just late for an anniversary dinner because mm-hmm. he's so engrossed in his work, and it turns out she's there to kind of celebrate their anniversary and kind of, you know, in his memory. But it's just mm-hmm. it's so expertly done that yes, you could definitely be blindsided by the ending. And I think it's a really smart movie.
Yeah, there's like, there's he does it with like so many like little tiny visual motifs, like the movie is kind of very gray and muted and cool colored, but then anytime red is involved is like kind of like a major emotional beat or something you know, kind of dreadful or scary is going to happen. He kind of does stuff like that, and then of course like the temperature differences when Cole is around ghosts, and like you kind of notice he's always wearing a jacket and bundled up when he's around Bruce Willis. You know, so like kind of, you know, little details like that kind of are just sprinkled in, and like, and then you go back and through and you're just like, oh yeah, Malcolm really does not interact with anyone. Like it's like you like kind of watch the movie and you realize that Bruce Willis and Toni Collette's characters never speak. Yeah. And you're like, if a kid's in therapy with a therapist, you'd think the therapist and the parent would be talking, right? You know, so it's like there's so many little details that you're just really not thinking about because we're so engrossed in this, and this character, in these characters, and this like very emotional kind of story about, you know, dealing with grief and pain and guilt in kind of the, in these ways. And so you're really engrossed in all that, that you're kind of ignoring all these like little things that, so again, when the twist happens, it's not like it just came out of nowhere. It's like, no, it's all the signs have been there. He's been doing, you know, like literally trying to tell you without, you know, outright telling you until the end.
Yeah. One thing that makes me laugh about this film, and you know, it was nominated for, I think, six Academy Awards. And then, you know, when people of a certain ilk talk about it, they're like, it's a supernatural drama or it's a psychological thriller. And you're like, no, it's a horror film. Like you can wrap it in as many wrappers and layers and labels, but it is a horror film. And there are really horrific moments in it that are really disturbing. And you know, one of the main things is obviously Misha Barton's ghost character that is so disturbing.
Yes, I totally, yeah, because like once I again, like I kind of thought that I had seen it, and I kind of always had this idea of it kind of being like, you know, this very kind of sad, droopy kind of movie. You know, but it does like have like, you know, that scene is absolutely terrifying. The scene where they're locking Cole and the dumb waiter, and he like is like hearing the voices of the murdered ghost kids in the house is absolutely terrifying. And like, yeah, there's so many elements. And then of course this being a ghost story, and like also like a modern like gothic story as well, kind of the way they like interweave like kind of the dark history of Philadelphia into the movie as well. So it's like there's a lot of very dark elements and you know, truly horrific scenes that put this firmly in the horror category.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just the sight of those people hanging in his school like that really freaked me. I was just like, whoa. And just even just the thought of like this tiny little like 9-year-old boy, and that's what he sees every day. Like, he should be more fucked up than he already is, like, to be honest.
Oh, I mean, seriously, this kid's life is so hard. And I mean, obviously, I mean, I feel like we've, you know, praised Haley Joel Osment for this performance, but like, I really don't think he gets like the credit that he deserves for like how much work he's putting into, because you really feel in the way that he speaks and like delivers lines, and he kind of always has this glossy look in his eyes, like as if he's like just on the verge of tears all the time, because he is dealing with just so much that he's like kind of keeping in. And he's playing like it very maturely. Like it feels like I'm watching just like a very small adult, except for like the times where he does like kind of light up and he gets to like be a kid again, you know, you know, what, like, you know, even though he sees ghosts and sees dead people all the fucking time, as and he's very miserable and his mom's kind of not around, you know. Those, it's like those things bother him, but it's like really like the true horror is he's just like, I just want to be a normal kid that like has like friends and like, you know, yeah, like, you know, plays with other kids and like does, yeah, you know, participates in the school play. Like those are the things that he really wants. And you just like want those things for him. So it's like Cole is so tragic, but performed just so spectacularly.
Yeah. And like, I feel like it's, despite its supernatural setting, it is kind of this portrayal of a child that, like you said, just wants to be a child, but has things like his mother works two jobs and she's not around and he's bullied by kids and no one understands him and he's just very, very alone, which is like what a lot of kids go through. And it's just a very relatable character played by this little 9-year-old boy. And he's, like I said, it's so gothic. Like he plays the haunted gothic child very well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was interesting, I guess. Initially, M. Night wanted someone like he kind of envisioned, you know, Cole being kind of more that kind of traditional haunted kid and like kind of playing on it and like him being a little bit more, you know, dour and kind of in a way. So when he like met Haley Joel Osment, he's like, oh my God, this kid's like adorable. Like how I can't believe that, I'm not going to believe that he's being haunted by ghosts. But you know, but with that kind of extra innocent look, it brings that extra like heartbreak to Cole's character.
Definitely. So I guess we can't really talk about The Sixth Sense without touching a little bit more on M. Night Shyamalan's other works that go with twist endings. So before we were kind of setting this all up, we were talking about The Village, which is another one that had a twist ending. So what do you think about his other films that contain these there?
I mean, I love M. Night. I'm a big Shyamalan fan, defender, if you will. And I always respect his choices, and I just felt like with The Village, it's a very interesting case of, because at the time people had just these expectations, you know, and then, I guess people, have a problem with the believability of some of these twists, and that could be extended into like, the ending of Old as well, kind of. Where people are kind of like, oh, like it's the unbelievability that doesn't work for me. And, but I think with The Village, like, I think like, and people take the twist of that and then they're like, oh, well then this like kind of reshapes like this whole thing. It's not a true horror movie. It's not a monster movie like we thought, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, no, I think the twist of that like makes it even more horrific, you know, like the kind of, you know, implications that it has for the film. So most of the time, so really for me, I think Sixth Sense, The Village, and maybe Old are the only ones that I would consider him having like actual twist endings. I know people debate the ending of Signs and think that's very silly, and I don't get why people are always so upset about the ending of Signs.
Yeah, The Visit was another one that I thought was quite an effective twist ending. I don't know if you've seen The Visit.
Yes, I have. I've seen that one, and that was kind of one I just kind of thought of it more of as like kind of a reveal, because I don't know, like, because I went into the movie and that's kind of what I expected. I was like, I was like, they're going and they think these are their grandparents and they're totally not their grandparents. So like when it's revealed that's like, no, they're not their grandparents, I was like, yeah, that's kind of what I was expecting. I don't know. So it kind of worked for me. So I didn't kind of think of it in that way.
Yeah.
But then like with Signs, people are like, oh, that's silly that the aliens, you know, their weakness is water. That's so silly. And it's like, well, one, he did set it up throughout the entire movie with all the glasses of water and the girl, the little daughter's, you know, thing against glasses of water and all these things. But then it's like that very much played on our expectations, like, as humans, in a way that like I love that we just assume that aliens are like these like super smart intelligent beings and like I'm sure there's aliens out there that aren't that smart and they would accidentally invade a planet that is 76% their weakness. I like, you know, but that's just on our expectations, you know? So I feel like it works super well in that. And I don't consider it a twist, but you know, for the village and old though, like I see why they're a little bit more contentious because they're maybe not executed as well as it is in The Sixth Sense.
Yeah. So would you recommend The Sixth Sense then to horror fans?
Oh, 100%. And again, like even if you do already know, which I'm sure you do, you know, the scary movies made sure to parody just about every M. Night Shyamalan film, especially the twists and things like that. So even if you do know, it's so worth it for it's just a very beautiful movie, like a very beautiful story. And very compelling characters. Bruce Willis is fantastic in it as well. So yeah, I 100% recommend it, even if you do know.
Yeah, same. Like before I would have been like, ugh, why bother? But I think just with the gothic setup, the actual horror elements of the ghost, like I love a good ghost story. And for Haley Joel Osment's acting, as well as Toni Collette, like I really love Toni Collette in this as well. Everyone's favorite horror mom. I definitely would recommend it as well. So out of the two films, if someone came to you and was like, so I want to watch a film that has a twist, I don't know why anyone would come to you asking this question, but sure, look, listen, it's my podcast, I can say things like this. If someone came to you and was like, I want to watch a film with a twist ending, but I've either got Perfect Blue or I've got Sixth Sense, which one would you recommend over the other?
I would, between the two of them, I would recommend Perfect Blue. Just because if that is what the person is looking for, then you kind of have the more fun experience of it, you know, because that movie is purposefully trying to toy with you and, you know, again, mess with your perception of the film and like what you're thinking about. So like it's more trying to be a twisty movie versus The Sixth Sense is just kind of a movie. And even if they didn't like have that twist at the end, like the rest of the movie would still hit in a way, but it's not as much of you watching and trying to kind of play the game and figure it out. So it's like, I think Perfect Blue is a more fun watch in that angle. But the both movies are 4.5 out of 5 stars for me. So they're both pretty bangers.
Yeah. I think I would go with Perfect Blue as well. I just enjoy it more as a journey film. Like visually, I love Sixth Sense, but I just think if someone was like, oh, I want to watch, you know, have a really good time with the twist ending, or not a good time, because I wouldn't say it's a good time. Perfect Blue. So thank you so much for coming on and chatting about twist endings. Now, before we go, I always ask my guests, what is your favorite horror film?
You know, of course, they rotate. We all have our favorite children. But it would be a tie between American Psycho, one of all-time best adaptations that, you know, shouldn't have worked as well as it did, but it just beyond against all odds, Mary Harron, you know, pulled it off, and it's an incredible film. And and The Neon Demon is one of my other films that I would say, like, if you really want to know my taste in films and kind of the way that my brain works, I would show somebody The Neon Demon, because that's kind of like the definition of my shit. So if you want to get to know me as a horror film person, that's a good place to start.
Yeah, that's definitely due a rewatch for me. I don't think I soaked it in as much as it needed to be when I first watched it, so it's definitely on my rewatch list. American Psycho, it's the first time that anyone has said that's their favorite horror film. Again, another bit of a twist ending, I guess.
It's a twist ending, but it's also, I feel like people don't think about it as a twist ending just because we truly don't get the answer. Like you can read the ending of that movie both ways and it makes sense. Like she very much like made it to where like it doesn't have an answer. So it's like, that's a very interesting case in the, in the twist ending canon.
Yeah, definitely. So where can people find you on social media?
You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd at _DaddyDisco. You can hear my podcast, Spectre Cinema Club, every Tuesday. We just wrapped up doing some remake and reimagining comparisons. And we're going into a celebration of camp horror for Pride Month. So super stoked for that. And you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Spectre Cinema, as well as TikTok and on all podcasting platforms.
So that was my chat there with Devon Taylor about twist endings in horror. And we talked about 1997's Perfect Blue, as well as 1999's The Sixth Sense. So I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Let me know what you think about it on all the usual social media channels, as well as Blue Sky, which is a new one. And don't forget to rate, review, subscribe on whatever podcast platform you're listening to us on. And don't forget to stay horrific. Goodbye.